Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone. My name is Kieran Tavem and as always, joined by my good friend in the United States, JJ Duke. JJ, how are you, mate?
Kieran, I'm good.
Busy week in the world of women's football to the point where really this podcast only centres on two main topics. The first, we will have a chat about the appointment of Phil Neville into the new role of England head coach and the unfortunate and very, very sad demise of the Boston Breakers, of course, folded this past weekend after running into financial difficulties, and those players have been distributed to other clubs. But JJ, as I said, first and foremost, Phil Neville, there was rumour, there were whispers that Phil Neville was going to be the New England head coach. We got a word about a week before it was announced that it could happen. Claire Rafferty then went on national radio over here and announced that he was possibly on the shortlist. All of a sudden, 2 weeks later, Phil Neville is confirmed as the England women's national team head coach. Now, you're a Manchester United fan. You've never hidden that before. So I'd like to get your take. Phil Neville, you will have seen a lot of him playing for Manchester United. We don't know much of him as a coach because he's not really got a lot of experience, which we'll talk about in a minute. But what did you make of it when you saw the news?
Well, I mean, like everybody, I was really taken aback. I mean, you said it straight up front. He doesn't have a lot of experience as a coach. He was a first-team coach under David Moyes for, a portion of the time that he was there, and then helped out his good buddy Ryan Giggs finish out the season. Then he was an assistant for what we call a cup of coffee with Valencia with his brother, and then helped out Salford City, I think, for a day. But, yeah, that's really it. We never knew him as someone outside of either being on the pitch or being in the commentary position, either at desk side or, you know, someone that would break down a match or, you know, talk about players and player ratings and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it was surprising. Obviously, you and I in the weeks prior to this talked about, you know, potential people that could be taking the role. But yeah, I don't think in our wildest dreams we would have thought that a Neville brother, let alone Phil Neville, not to say that Gary wouldn't have done an equally, or at least put up a good resume in his own right, but Phil Neville taking the job as the England women's national team head coach.
Is that making headlines over in the United States? Obviously, I know what I see on social media, but in terms of the soccer community out in the US, is this making headways? Is this making headlines over there?
I mean, I would lie to you saying if it was. Obviously, within the soccer community, yeah, people know about it. But for those that are of the avid watchers, I actually was talking to a friend a couple of days ago, and I said, hey, did you know that Phil Neville got the job? And he's like, I didn't even know Phil Neville was coaching anymore. So that tells you kind of everything that you need to know. But yeah, I mean, you know, people obviously in the community know about it. They were taken aback, obviously, things in terms of how Mark Sampson got nudged out of the job for all of his wrongdoings in the past. But yeah, it just took a lot of people by surprise, and it's really going to be curious to see how things go for him. And obviously, through the course of the show, we'll hear and we'll talk about more about what the potential goals for him could be. But obviously, he takes over a team right now that's really in a good position to not only medal, or quote-unquote medal, in the next couple of competitions, but to win the next couple of major competitions.
Yeah, we've got some audio from Phil Neville. I was able to speak to him yesterday. I was at St. George's Park at his official unveiling. But just before that, I managed to speak to Glenn Moore, and Glenn is a journalist for a national newspaper over here, or certainly was for a national newspaper. He freelances for them now. He's also the women's football writer for World Soccer magazine, and Glenn's covered men's and women's football for a number of years. So I wanted to get some insight from him because he's met Phil Neville. I know that he's been in press conferences with Phil Neville before, to get a bit of insight into the type of person that England are employing. So here's a quick chat with Glenn. So I'm really pleased to be joined by the women's football writer for World Soccer Magazine. He's also got over 25 years of experience covering both the men's and the women's game, Glenn Moore. Glenn, how are you?
Hi, Kieran. Very good, thanks.
Good, man. Thank you for joining me. Glenn, it's been a crazy few days over here in England with the appointment of Phil Neville as the England head coach, replacing Mark Sampson. The FA took their time over the appointment. I guess my first question is, what was your initial reaction, number one, when Phil Neville's name was being linked, and then number two, when he was finally confirmed?
Well, when it first came out, I think Claire Rafferty revealing it on radio, I was very surprised, to put it mildly. Talk about a name out of left field, someone with no experience in the women's game, someone who'd never managed, someone who'd never shown any interest in the women's game. So it did seem a very surprising name to come out. And clearly, as over the next couple of two or three weeks went by, it became obvious that the job was his to take. So I guess when it was finally announced, it wasn't a surprise, but it was still, you look at the decision and thinking, it's the most bewildering, I cannot recall a more bewildering choice of manager for an England men's or women's team ever, really.
And that's important, I think. I mentioned in the intro, you've covered largely men's football for that 25-year period, but certainly a long time covering the women's game as well. We've seen a number of coaches pass through the doors for the men's side. We've only seen a few in, what, the last 20 years, when you think Hope Power was in her role for a while. Mark Sampson had a few years as well. Compared to the furore that we've seen over the likes of Fabio Capello or Sven-Goran Eriksson, whoever it might be, where does this rank in terms of the attention that it's received and in terms of how different it's been?
Well, in terms of the attention compared to those sort of things, relatively small, in that, yeah, the men's game obviously in England is massive and there was huge attention. I mean, I remember when Eriksson was going to be appointed, a lot of us flew out to Lazio for his first game after the word had gone that he's going to become the next England manager. And I think in the end there was such a fuss around it, he cut short his time at Lazio and took up the job earlier than anticipated. And again, you know, press conference would be big set pieces with huge amount of numbers there. It would have been very, very hard for the FA to appoint an England manager for the men's team this week, as they announced him on Tuesday in Spain with a press release, and they wait 6 days until he meets the media, and he's meeting them on the Monday. I cannot imagine that happening in the men's game. It's just inconceivable. There'd be such clamour and demand to speak to him immediately. So, but in terms of the importance of the women's game, it's been much, much more attention than Mark Sampson got. To us, much, much more attention than anything that's happened in the women's game, I would say, apart from the Luca affair when the FA head honchos ended up in the House of Parliament being grilled.
Yeah, of course. And that obviously led, with a combination of other things, to Mark Sampson's departure. But we'll talk about Mark Sampson left under a cloud. Phil Neville has entered under one, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But from the experience that you've got of covering the men's game, I know we spoke beforehand, you've not met or interviewed Phil Neville on a one-to-one, but you've certainly had time in press conferences where he may have been speaking or time where you've been around him. What sort of person and what sort of coach are the England team getting in bringing him on board?
He'd be very diligent, hard-working. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think he's relatively bright. I think his brother's the smartest one. But, I mean, Phil's he's quite well. Yeah, he does think about things. He's got quite a depreciating line. I think we've seen it on the TV series they do with the Salford FC thing, himself. And certainly Gary's always been slightly the more in-your-face up front of the two brothers. But Phil, of course, wasn't such a good player. I guess was slightly in Gary's shadow. And for a long time, came through some difficult times with England. He was regarded as, what's he doing to the team? He got in the team very, very young. You may recall in the European Championships, it's his tackle that put England out of the European Championships in 2000. Keegan's team, hardly his fault. The team were very, very poor, badly managed. But it's his tackle that led to the crucial penalty that put England out. And he took a lot of stick after that. I guess that's all character building, a bit like his teammate David Beckham after 98. So he has actually put up with quite a lot in football. He became a very good captain for Everton after he left Manchester United. A lot of players leave Manchester United and their careers decline quite quickly, but Neville became quite a significant figure at Everton, despite initially a lot of uncertainty when he turned up, A, because he was ex-Man United, and B, he was always seen as a bit of a peripheral figure at United. One of those players who never quite nailed down a place in the team, but did a job in quite a few places. But he left because he knew he would never be in the first 11 if everybody was fit. That was basically the problem for him.
Yeah.
Whereas Everton, he became captain and became quite a significant figure. So you're going to get somebody diligent, who's hardworking, fairly smart. I'm not sure he's really a left field operator. Going to come up with anything really unusual in that respect. He's done all his badges. Yeah, that sums up the sort of, yeah, he approached it quite professionally in that respect. And clearly he's been in a winning environment, particularly under Alex Ferguson, where he's been in those situations. He's been playing for England at the highest level. The players will certainly respect his experience and his playing ability. So he brings all that to the table.
Yeah, absolutely. Ironically, you mentioned his badges. I think he did his UEFA Pro licence on the same course as Mark Sampson, so they no doubt know each other from that time together. But how significant is that experience that he had, do you think, as a player, those difficult times that he had? Because Baroness Sue Campbell came out this week, and Baroness Sue Campbell was the person responsible for leading the recruitment of the new head coach. And she said that some of the candidates were put off by the media scrutiny and the media landscape that currently exists around the England team. He's been in high-profile club, he's been in high-profile situations. How much of an advantage does that give him, do you think, with the way the media will respond, well, have already responded and are likely to respond maybe in his first few games?
I think to the extent he's been there and he's dealt with it in the past, what has been slightly unusual this week is because of the nature of his stuff on social media, the tweets, he's had his character questioned in a way that probably hasn't been the case in the past. And, you know, and what sort of bloke he is, to the extent his wife's had to come out and defend him. You know, he's really a nice guy, good husband, good father, etc. Because, you know, particularly the joking, as if he could possibly joke about, tweet about domestic abuse, batting his wife, has clearly gone down very badly. So he's got that experience behind him, and that will obviously help. I do think the idea that media scrutiny is a massive problem does seem slightly odd. I mean, it may be that some people have personal circumstances they wouldn't necessarily like in the media. Had the FA handled the whole Mark Sampson affair better in the first place, there wouldn't have been the press that followed it. So it's not really the media's fault. It's the FA's fault as much as anything. But he has got that experience, and that will help. I do think he's probably found this week a bit of a shock in terms of the nature of the scrutiny he's had.
Yeah, of course. He's got three very big games to start off with, hasn't he? He's got France, the United States and Germany in the She Believes Cup. We're going to find out very quickly, number one, what sort of coach he is, but number two, how he deals with coming up against the best teams. We know that England's qualification for tournaments tends to be, with respect to the teams that they're with, pretty plain sailing. But to start against number six, number one and number two in the world, it's a pretty almost into the fire, if you like, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very tough start, I must admit. You get sometimes these cases in the men's game in the Premier League where a manager comes in, but he doesn't come in quite as quickly as he might have done because he looked at the fixtures and thought, well, I'll give those two a miss and I'll come in then. Yeah, that is a tough three games. I mean, it will help that France and Germany are obviously big, powerful sides of their men's game because the knowledge of women's football isn't that great in English sports media. But France and Germany will be respected because their men's teams are respected. And there is an awareness that America is good at women's football. So it's not like, so if they don't get great results, I think there will be a broad awareness that they were playing good sides. But certainly that is a tough start. And the fact they did so well over there last year in the She Believes Cup means that's the barometer is going to be measured against. You know, last year beat America. You know, so if they lose all the games this year, it'd be a lot worse. The other game that's tricky, of course, is the Wales game. They can't afford to lose that, and Wales do have good players.
They do, and it's the first competitive game that he plays, isn't it? The three games in the She Believes Cup are essentially friendlies, but will present a really big challenge. You mentioned there, and I'll try and wrap it up shortly, but you mentioned there the lack of experience and knowledge of the women's game. A lot has been made of the coaches that he surrounds himself with. How important is that? And how much pressure are the FA under to get that right? Because it could be those people that really have a significant effect on how well Phil Neville does.
Well, they found a lot of pressure because they need to get it right and they need to show there is a pathway for women coaches in the game. It's an odd appointment, that second one, because it was advertised very late and fairly quietly and wrapped up very quickly. And clearly they're going through the applications now. I mean, we're being told it's probably going to be Casey Stoney and Mo Marley's dropping down a little bit and there'd be someone else involved as well. So The idea is it's a pathway, and therefore it's short-term parachuting in Phil Neville, and next time it will be someone from the women's game, and you need to get it right. The big question, of course, is will he listen? How much will he listen? How much will he delegate? I think Marianne Spacey felt that she wasn't really part of the team with under Mark, and that might be why she moved sideways at an odd time. Phil Neville, when he left Valencia, said when he went into a management job, he wanted to bring his own coach and his own team with him. Well, he's not going to be allowed to do that. So that's going to be interesting. You know, how much faith will he have in, say, Casey, for example, for one of a better guess? Yeah, how much will he have faith in someone who also has never managed when she says, well, we should be doing this, we should be doing that? So in terms of the knowledge that the assistants will bring, you know, this player does this player does that, or you've got to watch, you know, Lodi Thomas is very quick, or those sort of things. The knowledge will be very useful to him. But how much faith he will and trust he will have in his coaches, you know, how much they will feel they're being listened to, that's going to be the difficult relationship, because he won't know any of these people at all until this week.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll wrap it up. Final question. What does success look like for Phil Neville?
Well, given that Mark Sampson set a pretty high bar with two semi-finals, I think we're looking at the World Cup. Obviously, it's harder than the Euros because America are in it and one of the other teams. But semi-finals is pretty much par for England at the moment. Anything less than semi-final, you could say it's probably failure. It might depend who you get knocked out by in the quarterfinal. If you draw the USA and lose the USA, I guess there's no shame in that, or Germany. But really, England need to get to semi-finals. That's par. Success is reaching the final. You've always got to be better than the previous guy. There is no country in the world that's put as much money into women's football as the FA. The FA make a lot of mistakes with women's football, but you can't afford the amount of financial investment. And the team itself, when they go to tournaments, do not want for anything. Everything that could possibly be laid on is laid on. There are no excuses there. There's no problems with the kit or the training ground or the transport. All that stuff is done. The physios, the backup stuff. So there are no excuses. Semi-final level is the bare minimum. Success is reaching a final. You know, proper success is winning, which might be easier in the Euros in 4 years' time, particularly if, I'm not even sure it's not been decided yet. It might even be hosted here. You know, winning at home would be great, obviously. But, the bar's quite high.
The bar is high. Comes in with a lot of pressure, no doubt about that. Next few months is certainly going to tell us a lot about Phil Neville. Glenn, really appreciate your time. Remember, guys, Glenn is the women's football writer for World Soccer Magazine. Comes out every month, and I'm sure that the next edition will have a little bit on Phil Neville as well. Glenn, thanks for joining me, mate.
Okay, thank you.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSOZone.
So that was Glenn Moore. Don't forget to check out his column in World Soccer Magazine. JJ, one of the things that I know you and I picked up on from Glenn was talking about the kind of scrutiny that's come with the England national team role since Mark Sampson's departure. Obviously, there was a lot going on. The racism saga with Eni Aluko, the safeguarding issues that ultimately saw Mark lose his job. I think Glenn put it, you know, pretty bluntly that this wasn't necessarily a job that everyone wanted, and that could well be why Phil Neville has ended up in the role.
Yeah, I think to a point, you look at it, and obviously that comes with the surprising territory of his arrival and the signing of him to this job. But at the same time, you can almost kind of understand a little bit why the decision to bring him in was made. Get somebody that is completely out of the current system right now, someone that could bring in new ideas, fresh ideas, try to liven up the squad a little bit. And obviously someone of his caliber and his resume and his playing days, he knows how to play in the big matches. He knows how to be successful in those big matches. And clearly that could help this team, I think it was interesting. What did Glenn Moore say? That, you know, this team could pretty much guide themselves to their quarterfinals on their own in a major tournament, but it's taking that next step in succeeding in the last four and ultimately the championship match.
Yeah, this is it. And I think, you know, that's not being disrespectful to some of the smaller nations, but he's absolutely right. You know, this England team is super talented. They're third in the world. You know, Phil Neville is coming into an environment where, unlike Mark Sampson, who came in, I think England were ranked 14th, and he took them up to third in the world. Incredible job that he did. Whatever you think of Mark Sampson, you cannot question the job that he did for England. But now it's that final little stretch, isn't it? It's trying to overtake the Americans and the Germans, who are the two teams that sit above England. And Phil Neville has now got to figure out a way to try and outfox Steffi Jones and Jill Ellis. And that's going to be a difficult job, isn't it? Because the US and the Germans are used to winning. They've got that winning mentality, that almost arrogance that comes with winning. And that's something that he needs to now install into England, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost that killer mentality. Obviously, you're talking about Manchester United. He won the treble with them back in 99. So he knows not only how to handle with a grueling, daunting task ahead, but he also knows how to be successful in it. And, you know, you talked about the fact that he's coming into an environment, not so much the team per se, because the team and the unit in and of itself is very close, but it's an environment that perhaps, and quite frankly, is a little bit toxic at the moment because of the way of how Mark Sampson was fired from the position and, you know, how people came about it. So that's why I think this move, it's still a lot going to be determined if it was successful or not, sure. But in terms of maybe the person to go to, you know, outside of, you know, questioning what Mo Marley didn't do enough of to perhaps give herself a real look as opposed to just being the interim head coach. But, yeah, I like the decision. It's just only going to be a matter of time seeing how he goes about the Sheba Leaves Cup and obviously the next few World Cup qualifying matches, most notably the one coming up in April home to Wales. If he's going to be successful there, then this was probably the right decision that the FA made.
Now, we're going to hear from Phil Neville shortly. The press conference or the press day was split into two parts. So the mainstream media, which I don't fall into, we don't fall into, had about 20 minutes with Phil Neville, and they asked a lot of questions about his suitability for the role, criteria not necessarily being met. But they also discussed some tweets that were unearthed that I'm not going to read them out because I think people they're well known to people now. A few of the tweets were perceived and rightfully so as sexist. And then there was one tweet where he jokes about battering his wife. Now, these tweets were 6-7 years ago. The wording in them is unacceptable. It's immature. It shouldn't be coming from someone who should know better. He did explain in the media briefing that we had with him yesterday that the battering of the wife was actually in reference to they were on holiday, and it was actually in reference to beating her at table tennis or basketball. He can't remember which sport specifically it was, but he thinks it was table tennis. Now, that it changes the context completely, but it just shows how careful you need to be on social media, doesn't it? Because just battered the wife and just battered the wife at table tennis are two very, very different things, aren't they?
I mean, the way that social media, and actually, quite frankly, everything that surrounds what anybody does these days, it's so heavily scrutinized. I mean, they always teach us in school, right? Don't put anything out there, whether it's on social media or anything else, that could come back to hurt you. Because let's just think about it. You know, there's always going to be a digital footprint on the internet. So anything that you do, anything that you write, anything that you, well, can't say obviously verbally, but say out on the internet can come back and find you. And believe me, people know how to find things. Obviously, there could be a lot of digging. As you say, in Neville's case, there was 6-7 years worth of sifting through tweets to find this one. But clearly it was found. And, you know, it is at the end of the day for a lot of people a lesson in the sense of you don't want to, or you shouldn't be doing these things, period. But think about tweeting before you actually do it. And, you know, obviously, as you said, he, you know, apologized for what he said. He, you know, since deleted him from his account. But that, again, keeps the accountability on him, saying that, okay, so now at this point going forward, don't even think about it. Otherwise, just the, you know, the realm of the world that we are in right now, you can pretty much seal your own letter of resignation at that point. So, yeah. Big things coming, but obviously, again, it's just a warning sign and something that not only he, but at the same time, anybody in any sort of position of power just had to work on.
Yeah, absolutely. His wife and I think a few other people have come out and defended him and said that's just not him and it's not his character. And I have to say, he was very apologetic in the media briefing, whereas in the past I've seen people try and not necessarily gloss over these things, but they try and play them down. he openly admitted, he said, you know, I'm disappointed in the words I used. I need to look at myself in the mirror. There's no one else to blame but myself, you know, and I wholeheartedly apologize. And I'm not in any way saying that it's just a case of, right, now that he's apologized, forgive, forget, and we move on. It will take a little bit of time, but I think people now need to give Phil Neville a chance. You know, he's got the job, whether you agree with it or not, it's by the by. He has it. There were other candidates that were well documented and well publicised who dropped out for one reason or another. There are other candidates who've come out and questioned the appointment because their applications weren't looked at closely enough. But we are where we are. And as I say, there was a lot of conversation that was done with the mainstream media. There are a lot of articles online that you can find a bit of a breakdown of the things that he discussed with mainstream media. But women's football media specifically were given a separate briefing with Phil Neville. So we had a good 10 minutes with him to ask some football-related stuff. So rather than chatting on, you can hear from the man himself with his first media briefing with women's football media. So here he is.
Obviously, you're rusty in there about WSL top scorers and whatnot. I'm not going to be quite so cruel as that.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you've met the squad, you know the players, but how extensive at the minute is the knowledge? What advice are you taking from coaches and whatnot? Because obviously, you've got a squad to pick in.
Yeah.
In 3 weeks.
Well, I watched 30 players play on Tuesday against Holland. I watched two games over the weekend. I'm at a game on Thursday, game on Sunday. Do I know everything about the women's game? Every facet? No, but I will in a very short space of time. I think I said that in there. I have to get closer to my players. I have to know the ins and outs of what makes them tick. I need to know them as players, a character, every facet of their life. That's what I want to know, and that's what I have been doing, to be fair. I've seen every interview that they've done over the last 12 months. I've watched a lot of their performances over the last 12 months. I follow them on social media to know a bit more about their personal lives, because I think you can see. So I think that's management. Management is not just knowing what they can do on the pitch, it's actually getting to know them as people. And over the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks before she believes, I'll be going out and hopefully getting to know them even more by meeting them away from the football pitch. Because the 30 players that was in La Manga, I know the strengths and weaknesses of them. But that's the easy bit. The hard bit for me is to get them to know personally, and that's management.
What's the priorities for you? You mentioned She Believes a few times. It's coming up thick and fast.
Yeah.
For the next few weeks, what's the kind of priorities for you in terms of building up to that competition?
Look. The priorities, I'm talking about She Believes because that's the next competition. The priority is the World Cup qualifiers. But the priority over the next... I can't look beyond the next hour, to be honest with you. I've got that much in my diary. But the priority is actually to get my staff on board. I've got a meeting with the staff on Monday. By the end of this week, I will have my close staff, my assistants, my goalkeeping coach, hopefully named, and we can start planning. We can start planning. I can start showing them my vision for this team. And I've met a couple of the candidates, and we've got more to meet later in the week.
I'm not going to ask you about individual players, I don't think that's fair, but
yeah.
The three games that you have got coming up in She Believes,
yeah,
are,
yeah,
three of the top ranked six sides. What do you know about them at the moment, and what are you going to do to try and learn as much as you can ahead,
well,
of those games?
I know France. I've watched us play against the US. I watched the USA play against Denmark. I will know everything about my, one of my strengths is analysing football games. I know that the USA team, and that match in particular, will be an absolute fantastic occasion. It will be a fantastic test. The whole tournament will be for me to assess my players in probably the kinds of arenas that you have to perform in. If we want to be the best in the world, then you've got to perform in tournaments like the She Believes. And I know a lot about the French because I've studied them. And the USA are the USA. The USA play with confidence. They play with an arrogance that I think we need to probably learn a little bit from. They know they're number one. They believe they're number one. And it's up to us to knock them off their perch.
I know one of the things that you'll be doing is, as you've already said, getting to know your players. When a new head coach comes in,
yeah,
there's kind of a tendency to maybe review the captaincy. Have you made a decision about what you want to do regarding the captaincy? And
yeah, Steph will continue. She knows that.
Phil, She Believes almost a good first camp for you to have, because there's no illusions of what you're up against. You're playing three of the best teams in the world, and you get 10 days away with
Look, it's whether your glasses are full or half empty. You can look at it as fearful. I'm actually looking at it. I wish it was starting tomorrow, because what it will do or what it will give me is it will give me an opportunity to spend 12 days with my team, with my staff, to get to know them better. Because, you know, people are saying about me coming from the men's game into the women's game. If you go into any job, you have to get to know your players. When I moved to Valencia, I had to get to know all my players inside out. It's easier if you're on the road with them. It's easier if you're sharing meals with them, if you're in hotels and you're on planes, because you can get quality contact time with the team and with the staff. The staff have to get up to speed with me. I've told them that. You know, I'll be putting massive pressures on my staff and my players, but ones which I think they will enjoy. And the She Believes can't come quick enough, because ultimately what the She Believes will give me, it will give me the opportunity to coach the team, and that's what I'm here to do, to coach the team, to make them better, to win football games, and all the rest that surrounds that actually is not as important as that bit.
You can watch WSL games week in, week out. What will you do to keep tabs on the likes of Jodie Taylor and Rachel Daly out in the United States, Lucy Bronze out in France? There's a player, Leah Galton, who is probably got
Tony
potential
at Barcelona
to,
as well.
Tony at Barcelona.
Yeah, well, I aim to go to see Lucy. I told her the other day, Barcelona, that would be a nice trip.
Yeah, I'll go Leon.
Yeah,
they've got
Barcelona, Leon, Plaitchel, but that's in March. Yeah. That's after the She Believes. So, look, it's part and parcel of being an international manager. That you've got to go and look, you can see the games, but it's actually, you know, when I go to Lyon or Barcelona, it's actually probably spending a bit more time with them on a one-to-one basis. I think management now is all about building relationships, and Lucy, without doubt, is one of our finest players, and such a key player going forward. And you know, I watched a couple of players over the weekend, young players that won't go to She Believes, that I think will go to 2019 World Cup in France, that excite me equally as much as the 30 players I met the other day.
Is there anyone that particularly stood out over the weekend for you?
Well, I think it's unfair for me to probably name names, but
I've seen a few.
Seen a few, but there was a young player that genuinely excited me on Saturday. I'm not going to name a name because I don't want to put pressure on. She's still got to develop, but I think we've got a crop of young players that are coming through that could really put pressure on the experienced players in the team.
What did you think of the games you watched at the weekend, and the quality of the football?
The quality of the football I thought was fantastic. The game yesterday was feisty. It was tough. It was very competitive, and everything that I believed it would be. You know, it was the game on Saturday. I think Liverpool probably had more experience. Bristol City were a young team, but Bristol City were really impressive in the system that their coach tries to play. And yesterday was a London derby, and both teams. It was obviously history between the two teams. It was competitive. And I learnt a lot.
Phil, right. one more.
Phil, final for me. I mean, your predecessor Max Hampson obviously got the team to third in the world. It wasn't always the most entertaining football, but he won matches, and that's where we are now. Your style moving forward, is it about winning? Do you want to win with a certain style, or do you just want to get to number one, come what may?
I want both. I think that's important, and you know, I think Mark did a fantastic job. The foundations are fantastic here. But I think to get to number one, I think you have to do both. I think you have to play with a certain style. I think the players now are, I'm not saying demanding, but they're ready to play with a style. They feel, you watched the game Arsenal yesterday and the game on Saturday, both centre-backs playing out from the back, playing with a certain style into midfield, entertaining in the wide areas. And I think that's what we need to get to in the full team. The players can do it. I've seen them do it. And they're just going to have to do it on the biggest stage now.
Have you watched any of the Euros?
Euros back that we got knocked out of, disappointing. But, you know, after the success of the World Cups, then going into the Euros, there's a lot more expectation on the team. I think whenever you have that expectation of being the third best team in the world, it's something that we're going to have to deal with all the time now. It's managing that expectation. I'm actually going to try and raise the expectation and push, and that's one area I'm going to push, is that actually we want this expectation, we want this pressure, and in critical moments like against the Dutch, we have to be better, and that's what we'll be aiming to do.
Is that something that you're thriving on? I mean, this will be the first time going into a World Cup that England will be one of the favourites. So one of the favourites going into the Euros at 2017, but 2015, no one really expected them to get that third place finish. This is the first time going into a World Tournament England will go in as one of the favourites. That's something that you're thriving on. You're talking about raising that expectation. Is that something that you want to almost play on a little bit?
Yeah. I think, and I relate it back to the American team, the way that they puff the chests out and say, we actually like this expectation. We're the best team in the world and we believe it. And that's the kind of arrogance that I want from my team. And we shouldn't be embarrassed about being third in the world. We shouldn't be embarrassed about being named one of the favourites. And if anyone that is, really they shouldn't be in the squad, because we're going in a certain direction. And I've spoke to the team about this, and they have the same beliefs as me now. We're going in a direction where we want to be the best. It's going to be really difficult. Nobody's going to come and just give it to us on a plate. But we are going to give it our best shot, and we're going to make sure that we do it with a certain style. And I think everyone's genuinely excited. And, you know, first things first, we've got to qualify. You know, we can't take that for granted. You know, the games against Wales and Bosnia and Russia this year, it's a big six months for the team. And then looking forward, going to a World Cup.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
JJ, we'll wrap it up really quickly before we talk about the Boston Breakers. But I just wanted to kind of pick up on what Phil Neville was saying about, you know, now really trying to focus in on the She Believes Cup and wanting to learn about his players and the teams that are going to be, that he's going to be competing against. You know, he said that he's studied France very closely. He watched the USA's game against Denmark. And these, granted, are the sorts of things that coaches need to be doing. But at least it's encouraging, isn't it? You know, it's not that he's come into this and it's been, you know, spoken to by the media and he's not actually seen anything and doesn't know anything, which is kind of the perception that some people have of him already.
Yeah, I mean, he's been visible and he's saying the right things that he needs to be said. Obviously, he went to two WSL matches over the weekend. He, you know, talked about the fact that, you know, the USA have this quote unquote arrogance and how they puff out their chest knowing that they're the best. Well, I mean, guess what? That's what they've been doing for the last couple of decades. And that's the reason why that they've been one of the most successful nations in women's football. So, yeah, he's saying the right things, which is a good start. But Kieran, as you and I both very well know, this is a results business. If he doesn't get the results, maybe not so much in the She Believes Cup, but let's face it, if England doesn't win the group for World Cup qualifying, then it was a failure.
Yeah, She Believes Cup, I think performances are more important than results, certainly for him early doors. He needs to figure out his team, figure out his system, figure out the style of play that he wants. But we shall find out, mate. You and I will be at She Believes Cup in New York. I'm going to be heading to Orlando as well. The first game against France will be in Ohio. So we'll have to see how that one pans out. But we'll have a quick break, mate. And when we come back, unfortunately, some sad news and a sad subject that we have to talk about, because it was the end of the Boston Breakers this past weekend. And we're going to have a chat about that after this break.
Women's Soccer Zone. We'd like to thank our partners, She Kicks Magazine. Subscribe at shekicks.net for even more women's football.
So JJ, we said at the beginning of the show that we had some sad news that we needed to discuss, and it's the folding of the Boston Breakers, the only club that remained in the NWSL that had performed in the original WUSA, Women's United Soccer Association. Is that what it standard for?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, Women's United Soccer Association, back in the early 2000s, formed after the 99 team, the US, 99 US team won the World Cup. And then obviously the Women's Professional Soccer, the WPS, back in the late 2000s and early 2010s. And then obviously going into the NWSL. And I know that they had some time in some of the sort of semi-professional amateur leagues as well, didn't they, in between them?
Yeah, that they did. I mean, really, if you're thinking about American women's professional soccer, you think about the Boston Breakers. I mean, they've been there, as you said, since day one. In terms of like an organized leagues, you could look back to the mid-90s when you really want to talk about top caliber club soccer, though, in the USA. You look at WUSA, the Breakers were there, played, you know, some good football, obviously had some legendary names come through that club, not only in WUSA, but WPS, you know, groundbreaking start for some players that really were key contributors on the 2011 and 2015 Women's World Cup team. And then, yeah, just carried the torch forward into the NWSL. You expected them to be there when it started, and they were. And, you know, it's really one of those moments, Kieran, that it's kind of a dark day for U.S. women's club soccer when you see really the last stand of what was kind of the original clubs go down, because they've been there, like I said, since the beginning. And, you know, a lot of good people work with that organization that are going to be, unfortunately, without jobs as we speak. And, yeah, you know, it was not a happy day for a lot of people.
How's it come to this then? You know, it was announced last week. We kind of jumped straight in, but it was announced last week that the club would be ceasing operations with immediate effect. There were a lot of rumours that were doing the rounds that the club was struggling financially. There was supposedly a buyer in place who pulled the plug at the 11th hour. There was then a suggestion that there was a last minute proposal put forward by a consortium of individuals or an individual who was willing to potentially buy the club that wasn't deemed suitable and too late to join the party. How is it that a professional club with such a rich history has been able to get into such financial ruin that it ends up having to fold?
I mean, we're never going to know truly what actually happened with the old ownership group. I mean, for years, what my understanding was, things were operating, not to use the words of what was talked about in the weeks leading up to this, but as it were, it was smooth up there. I mean, this is a team that not only had the first team, the professional team, but they built pretty much the first true pyramid in American women's club soccer, where they had, you know, reserve teams, they had college academy teams, they had the youth academy, pretty much all the way down to the grassroots level. So you'd think, okay, so this organization is running at least well enough that we'd never think that it'd come to this. But I would have to assume, and again, this is me assuming things, there's no, you know, any proof to any of this, but you have to assume that the rental fees at Harvard have become too much. You have to assume that with one or two of whatever the original ownership group or the last ownership group felt that they weren't truly getting the return that they were hoping for and felt that there was no longer a need. And yeah, then everything kind of domino effect. And then you talked about, you know, a potential buyer coming in the 11th hour or somebody that was trying to save it really late. Listen, we've seen that before happen. And quite frankly, it would have taken a absolute miracle to seeing the Breakers be on the field in 2018 when it was pretty much reported that everything was done and dusted. So there's a lot of elements that probably came into this, a lot of which we probably will truly never know the full extent of it. We did hear rumors and things floating around on social media that the other owners may have been helping in the league, you know, put up some money so that the team could finish out last season. Whether that's true or not, we may never know. But it sounds like this wasn't just something that came to fruition overnight. This has been something that could have been going on for months, if not years.
How much of a wake-up call is this to the league? You know, we talk about this league on every podcast, widely perceived to be by a lot of people as the best league in the world. However, we find ourselves in a position where the most historical club in that league with the most history has folded. And I don't see clubs folding in some other leagues, mate.
Yeah, no, you don't. I mean, obviously in America, you operate as franchises, which comes a little bit of a different business model at the end of the day. But you talk about the one club, the Breakers, you know, being folded. Let's not forget the fact that Western New York, basically, they were on the brink of folding. And then North Carolina comes in and gets that franchise. Then this past offseason, there have been questions for a long time about the Kansas City organization, whether they're going to stay afloat or not. And then Utah all of a sudden comes to birth. Now, I don't know, if we're ever going to classify that as FC Casey relocating to Utah or Utah gaining a franchise and FC Casey folding. But since this quote-unquote groundbreaking deal with Lifetime Networks, A&E Networks, we've seen three original NWSL franchises folding or relocating in the span of, 14 months? That's not exactly a great look on the independent clubs. Now, I say independent because you look at, obviously, some of the other operations. You have Portland, you have Houston, Orlando, and now Utah, owned by MLS clubs. So to answer your question, Kieran, I don't think this is a shot so much as the league. I think the league, as it were, sure, there are many problems to it and many things that can be fixed, but that's the same case in nearly every league. This is a real warning call to the rest of the independent or operations or teams that are not backed by male organizations or male clubs. Portland, obviously, with the Timbers. I mentioned all the MLS teams. You have North Carolina, which is operated by a lower division team. But, the Sky Blues, the Washington Spirits, the Chicago Red Stars, the Seattle Reign. I mean, those are independently run franchises by one or two owners and not underneath an umbrella. So I think that, that's going to be telling something for us. Any expansion team that's going to be coming in, it would be a shock if it's not going to be a team that's affiliated with an MLS or a USL franchise.
This is one I genuinely don't know the answer to, and I'm not sure if you do, but why is it with potential cities having an interest in an NWSL franchise, they may not be ready now, but they may be ready in 2019 or 2020? Why couldn't the league suspend the Boston Breakers license, for example, and then when a team is ready to create a franchise, they could have moved the Breakers to Los Angeles or to somewhere where there is an appetite to have a franchise?
Well, I think this is almost kind of like that, if you will. I mean, you're talking about suspending a franchise. So what you're saying, and I'm going to get clarification before I answer this. So to have all their players, if you will, be on a freeze as well, the team, and then look to see if something pops up in the future?
Well, I guess a lot of those players would have to find clubs elsewhere, but it could almost be like loans, if you like, and then, or players coming to Europe or going to Asia, wherever it might be. And then when that franchise is ready, they are all that club retains their rights, and as soon as they are in a position to move that franchise to a new city, those players all return.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. I didn't actually really think about that. I mean, I give obviously the league credit in the sense that they had this dispersal draft and made every player, whether they're contracted right now, whether they're a draft picker, they fell into the realms of retired players or players that still the Breakers had rights to, opportunities for jobs. And I think only a couple of players will obviously get into the dispersal draft in just a little bit, but every player had an opportunity to get picked, and they don't get hurt in the current roster rules. It's pretty much almost kind of like a Band-Aid to cover it this year. But yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. At the end of the day, look, I think there are going to be future expansion teams. Just the question of when is it going to happen? Hopefully at least a couple starting next year. And I put this out publicly that I think if the league doesn't have at least one expansion team, ideally, I think, even though it created a bit of an odd number schedule again, but if they don't have two really by the start of next season, I think really the league, not to say it's in trouble, but in terms of this being the ideal league for players to want to play in because of the limits of jobs that are available, there could be some definite issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think it would be really, really important for 2019 that we have at least one expansion team to bring the league back up to 10 teams. Of course, with LAFC starting in the MLS this season, they have been a team that have been highly touted. There, of course, is no women's team franchise in Los Angeles at the moment. Big sports market there. So be interesting to see how that one works out. I mean, before we talk about what happened as a result of the Breakers folding, what's your fondest memory of the Breakers, JJ? Obviously, we said, lots of history there. very, very sad to see that club removed from the league. But what's your fondest memory of the Breakers?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of, you know, the moments, like you said, you know, they're the team that's been there kind of since the beginning. Yeah, they played in a number of really important and cool venues all throughout the Boston city limits, obviously playing at the historic Harvard Stadium. They played at Nickerson Field at BU, obviously then moving over to Alston. It's kind of funny, though, if you actually want me to talk about the fondest, I think kind of the memory that comes up to mind, you mentioned about the semi-pro teams right at the beginning of this segment. I remember in the 2012 season when they were, I believe, the only one of the quote-unquote pro teams in the WPSL elite to actually fall to an amateur team. They lost to the New England Mutiny. I remember that game and how crazy it was. I was like, oh, wait a minute, this actually happened. I mean, that's kind of a negative thought, but it's one that comes to mind. But look, like I said, they're a franchise that a lot of good people supported. Obviously, I know the fans are going to be devastated. And personally, you know, the director of communications, Ryan Wood, who not only was brilliant at his job, was a little bit of a mentor to me as well, kind of getting my start in the journalism game and covering women's soccer. So I'm obviously gutted for him, as well as, you know, Matt Beard, who's an A-plus guy and a very good coach, and hopefully he gets a job sooner rather than later. But yeah, those are the things that I'll probably remember from the Breakers.
Yeah, I'd echo that. Very, very difficult to disagree with you. I think for me, I have to credit the Breakers for almost igniting my interest in US women's professional soccer, because it was not long after I met Kelly Smith, probably in, well, beginning of 2009, maybe end of 2008. She obviously soon after that made the move to the Breakers for the WPS, and I remember staying up late a few times watching her and Alex Scott, and I think Laura Del Rio was possibly part of that team. Leslie Osborne, Heather Mitz, I think, was in that team as well. And I remember watching them in WPS action, and it was definitely the Breakers that initially got my interest because of Kelly and Alex and all those other players that were playing. And I seem to remember, well, as we know, the WPS folded and was struggling financially because of it, but the WPS had some huge players playing in that league, and the Breakers had their fair share of them. So really, really sad, gutted for the, obviously being based in the UK, I'm gutted for the likes of Matt Beard and Tash Dowie, and I'm disappointed for those players. But as we were discussing earlier, a number of those players have new homes, don't they? Because as a result of the Breakers folding, the league announced that there would be a dispersal draft, which would involve the players, essentially a bit like a college draft, being selected by the remaining 9 NWSL clubs. The order was determined. Do you want to explain how the order's determined, JJ? Could you explain it to me? And I didn't take it in, so maybe it's better you explain it.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, so it was kind of a weighted draft. So how they wrote it was all the teams that did not make the playoffs last year got 2 envelopes, or I guess actually maybe put it in something that you would kind of know a little bit more, Kieran, like in the FA Cup, everybody gets drawn out of, you know, the sack with a couple of, you know, every ball has the one number or something like that. So there you go. Every team got 1, but all the playoff or the non-playoff teams, excuse me, got 2 cracks at it. So there were, you know, 2 envelopes for 5 teams, 1 for 4 teams, and then it kind of weighted it that way. So it ended up being Sky Blue first, then Washington, and then so on and so forth. Kind of always surprising how Portland ends up in the tops of nearly everything. They got a 4th overall pick despite winning the league last year. But there you go. So that's how the format was.
But there was a trade, wasn't there? And it wasn't Sky Blue that ended up picking first, because we were expecting them to potentially add to their ranks with Rose Lavelle, but it was the Spirit who ended up picking first, because they made some trades with Sky Blue, and it was they that picked up Rose Lavelle to go alongside fellow internationals, including Andy Sullivan, Mal Pugh, Rebecca Quinn, who they picked up in the 2018 college draft. It was probably a couple of years ago that people looked at the Spirit and thought, maybe not a couple of years ago, because a couple of years ago they made the championship game, but there have been times over the years in the NWSL where the spirit maybe haven't been taken seriously. I think it would be the fairest way to describe it. They'll be taken seriously this year, won't they? Because with some of the picks they've got, man, they look strong.
I mean, this is a team now that's almost identified themselves as rebuilding with youth. I mean, they have the core of pretty much what is the younger players of the U.S. national teams. You mentioned already Sullivan with Pugh, now getting Lavelle. I mean, you kind of look at that and say, wow, that's a really good start right there, because you can almost kind of build that team right through the spine, if you will. Then you talk about Rebecca Quinn, who really can play anywhere along the back line or as a holding midfield. And that's already adding to a team that has got a lot of good players to it in and of itself. I mean, you look at Stephanie Labbé, who's still contracted with the club. I rate her as one of the better goalies in the entire world right now. Havana Salon, who I think has got a lot still to grow in her game, but her ceiling is very, very high. Franny Ortega is a very solid forward. Joe Lohman's coming back off of an injury and still has a lot to give. And Tori Huster, who you can't even think about the Spirit without thinking about what she's given to this team over the years. And her and Maggie Doherty Howard, yeah, that this team right now, on paper, they look really good because of the amount of youth that they've gotten. That doesn't even go into the amount of players that they've traded to get over the last couple of weeks. So, yeah, the Spirit right now are sitting pretty at the moment.
Yeah, I think they look good. Now, it would be difficult to go through every single pick because it would take us a while. So I'm just going to reel off maybe the top 10 and then we'll pick up some of the others that stood out. So, as I've already said, Rose Lavelle went number one to the Washington Spirit as a result of the trade with Sky Blue. Sky Blue therefore had number two, and they went with Savannah McCaskill, who was of course drafted by the Breakers only a few weeks ago in the NWSL College Draft. Seattle Reign picked up Megan Oyster, JJ. Now, I'll come back to that one because I think that's a decent pickup for Seattle. The Portland Thorns picked up Midge Purse. The Utah Royals picked up Abby Smith, good young goalkeeper. Good to see her get a job within the league. The Houston Dash picked up the rights to Kaya Simon, the Australian international. Rosie White, the New Zealand international, has gone to the Chicago Red Stars. Elizabeth Addo, Ghanaian international, has gone to the Seattle Reign. And Julie King, the Boston Breakers captain, or former captain, should I say, has gone to the North Carolina Courage. And the Courage also have the number 10 pick, and they picked up Canadian Alicia Chapman. Now, as I said, I want to go back to number 3 pick for the Seattle Reign. Now, a lot of us expected Abby Smith to actually be selected because we found out this week that Haley Kottmeyer has been traded to the Orlando Pride. We'll talk about that on the next show because there's been a few trades in the NWSL that have taken place that we need to cover. But they signed Michelle Batos earlier on in the day, which covered their goalkeeping situation. So they went with Megan Oyster at number 3. Now, I think Megan Oyster has the potential to cement a place in the US Women's National Team squad, and it might just be working with Vlatko Andonovski and playing at the Reign allows her to do that.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, you look at her skill set already that she has on the table. You talk about Vlatko Andonovski and what we saw with his style of play in Kansas City. Short passes, but continue that sort of flow and rhythm where you can make the field as wide as possible. And one thing that, you know, over not only just the women's game, but soccer as a whole, is the ability to start attacks from deeper lying positions and, you know, kind of have that game that can be free-flowing, can pick apart that killer ball, whether it's from the midfield to the forward, even from the defense, you know, into more of an attacking position. I think Oyster, her game is very, very solid as it is. You know, relentless pursuer of any 50-50 challenges, can be very good in the air. You know, we haven't seen too much of her in terms of getting in front of goal. Maybe perhaps a little bit more to come off of, you know, working with set pieces and stuff. But talking about that short passing ability, that's where I think Vlatko can add to her game and couldn't push that ceiling very high to the point where you're going with, where she could very well be getting opportunities with the national team camp within the next couple of years.
Yeah, agreed. Totally agree. Was there anything that stood out for you? As I say, difficult to kind of go through 30-odd picks. Granted, the teams kind of passed on picks by the end of the draft, but I was surprised to see Alicia Chapman go so late at number 10 to the Courage, but I do think that is a really good pickup for them. But I do wonder how that works, because obviously they have a very good outside back in that position already in Jaylene Hinkle, so be interesting to see how they fit Alicia Chapman into that one. Maybe they've drafted her to trade her, I don't know. Was good to see Julie King also get picked up by the Courage, really loyal servant to the Boston Breakers, and I think probably their most consistent performer in 2017. Morgan Andrews going to the Reign as well, JJ. I know you liked that one because I think I saw you tweet out, or certainly I saw a few people tweet out, that they think if anyone's going to get the best out of Morgan Andrews, it's going to be Vlatko Andonovski. We've already spoken about Megan Oyster, but very quickly, because I don't want to focus too much on the Reign and leave everyone else out, but quick one on Morgan Andrews going there.
Yeah, I mean, another one of those players that sees the field, I think, better than a lot of other young players. And this is someone who shockingly fell out of the U.S. Youth National setup. She was one of the last cuts for the under 20 Women's World Cup, when I thought it was a shoo-in for her to get in. But she, you know, rebuilt her game when she was at USC. Can pick apart that killer pass from 50 yards out with the ball down channel or over the top, but she can play the short game too, and she's got, you know, great skill and great shooting boots on both of her feet. Now, last year, challenging year for her, both professionally, but a lot of it was due to the fact that she was still taking classes at USC, so she was flying back and forth between Boston and Los Angeles. And for those who have never done it before, friends, it's a challenge. So, yeah, you know, she didn't get maybe the opportunities that she would have liked last year, but you know what? That speaks volumes to her, because at the same time, she wanted to get that degree. She, you know, sees other opportunities outside of the game as well. I think she went on social media once. It was talking about the fact that, you know, women's footballers have more than one job here in the U.S. and she works in production. And I mean, that just shows the type of person that she is, that she's multifaceted everywhere. But now, talking about her on the field, getting her in that Seattle system, keeping her on the West Coast, similarly to Oyster, I think Vlatko can get a lot out of Morgan Andrews, and she can revitalize her game, and again up in the Pacific Northwest.
Should rewind a little bit. We mentioned it earlier. Number 7, Houston Dash, picked up the rights to Kaia Simon. At number 13, they picked up Swedish under 23 international Lotta Ockvist. We're a little bit surprised by those picks, and that maybe they didn't go for some more maybe experienced defenders that could offer them some support.
I mean, yeah, we can be surprised. Obviously, when you talked about North Carolina going for Julie King and Alicia Chapman, obviously Chappie was there before in Houston, if my memory serves me correct. So, that one's surprising. I mean, I know, you know, Kaia Simon has been, you know, here in the U.S. before, played with the Breakers in the WPSL Elite days and also a couple seasons in the NWSL, got injured, is really getting her career back going down in the W League this season. I wouldn't have been shocked, if she did find her way back here to the league this year. But yeah, Houston's taking a risk, because what was pointed out, because she had, you know, left the league, the rights of hers were still with Boston. She is one of those players that's not fully protected under this list. If Houston goes out and signs her, she takes up a roster spot, have to obviously pay her outright amongst other things. So yeah, the Dash are taking a real risk in having her go. But I do, you know, go back to the fact that the assistant coach of the Dash now, which is Lisa Cole, was her manager when Kaia was in Boston. So could that connection be something that could woo her back to Houston? Yeah, possibly.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Interesting. I know a lot of people following it all on social media, mate, liked Angela Salem back to the Portland Thorns at number 15. She's going to add some steel to that midfield, isn't she?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a player that grew her game to new levels under Mark Parsons. And, you know, that middle of the park, obviously with Amandine Henry no longer in the setup, still a little bit congested at the moment. Obviously, Portland brought in Andresa earlier this year, still have a few options in that center midfield role sitting underneath Christine Sinclair. But again, depth is a beautiful thing. And looking with the Portland setup right now, they still have a number of international players who will be missing time. So, you know, the opportunities that Portland present, they've shown in the past where Mark Parsons or whoever, you know, the coach was at the time in years past, and obviously one of those being Paul Riley, you have to go deep with that team because you have to manage the fact that you got a lot of A-plus personalities and a lot of top talent. So, yeah, can Salem make a difference? You know, maybe not right off the bat, but in due time, she could.
Yeah, I agree. I like Angela Salem. Had a good season in Boston last year. Obviously, difficult season for them, but I think she was definitely one of the standouts along with the likes of Julie King. We've mentioned a lot of names, mate. There's a few we haven't mentioned. I think Adriana Leon going at number 17 was very, very surprising because she was, for me, Boston's best player last year, probably alongside Salem. So that one was a surprise. The other one that we're not sure about is Tash Dowie. Now, Tash Dowie, in a lot of mock drafts for this dispersal draft, was expected to go quite high. She didn't get selected at all. So that probably, we believe, suggests that she may have withdrawn and maybe has a move planned elsewhere. We don't know for certain, but that's kind of the assumption, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd have to say so. I mean, you know, you look at the board of all the players that were quote-unquote eligible to be selected, which was, if my math was correct, 30. Yeah, there were a couple of players that were left off. Two of those were retired players, Molly Pathman and Louis Schilgard. We pretty much know the reasons why that they've retired and been out of the game for a little while. Haley Dowd, who was a very much on the edge of the roster for the Breakers last year, but then Dowie. I mean, the fact we thought that, you know, she could be a top four, top five pick because she's, you know, someone that hunts the ball down in the box and could put them home with the best of them. But not getting selected, yeah, and you would know because you've seen her obviously play a lot back in England. She could very well be coming back home. I mean, that's just my assumption, but it sounds like she's going to be staying across the pond and not coming back.
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't you? I mean, the only other thing is that she has a move lined up for somewhere like Sweden or Germany or something like that. Maybe she fancies a new challenge, you know, if she's done well in the States, well in Australia, well in England. Maybe she thinks, do you know what, I want to try my hand at another league. And if that's the case, then it'll be good to see where she does end up. But yeah, interesting one with Tash Dowie. So we'll have to figure that one out when as and when it's announced. But good to see a lot of players get new homes, isn't it, JJ? Good to see the league have been sensible in saying that these won't contribute to the roster sizes because obviously there is the maximum number of 20. Doesn't go towards the salary cap either. So it gave the clubs a little bit more freedom, didn't it, to select these players? Because if it did go towards roster sizes or the roster cap and the salary cap, may well have been that we saw a lot of these players unselected.
Oh, it would have been zero players that probably would have been selected, maybe one or two at most, because you look at, you know, how the setup already of the league is. I think Seattle may have had a couple open spots. I think Sky Blue may have had one open spot. That and Utah obviously could have a couple of spots open there, but that's really about it in terms of, you know, which teams after the college draft maybe had anything open. So yeah, it's good to see that the league is doing the right thing about this. But again, it's going to come back to, this is just a 1 year band-aid, because you'd have to assume once next year end or this coming season ends, if they're going to keep it back to 18 to 20, a lot of these players are going to have to find jobs. If they don't expand the roster size / don't have at least one expansion team to come. That's obviously for the future. Shouldn't really be going on that right now, but it is something to keep in the back of the mind.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, I think we should wrap it up there, mate, with the chat on the Breakers and the earlier chat on Phil Neville's appointment with England. This has been not as packed a show as we normally have, but it's been two subjects that have obviously made a lot of headlines in the world of women's football. So we wanted to give them the coverage and the in-depth chat that it needed. So we'll call it a day there. I will thank you, as always, for your time, my friend.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as you said, these are two issues that, well, we weren't exactly hoping to have to dedicate an entire show to, because there are obviously still a lot of big things happening out there. But you're right, giving it the time that they deserve. And I know starting in our next show, we're going to get back to looking into what should be a very, very busy and interesting year of women's football.
Absolutely, absolutely. Lots coming up. I'm going to be in Lyon this coming weekend. I'm going to their game against Montpellier, so we'll have to see how that one pans out. And I know that there's a few one-to-one podcasts that we've got lined up. And of course, there's always content going up on womenssoccerzone.com. So thank you, listeners, for tuning in as always. Thanks for your support. We always appreciate it. If you want to contact us, you can do. We're on Twitter on @WosoZone. You can email us on wosozone@gmail.com to download the show. You can do so via iTunes or, of course, on womenssoccerzone.com, which is where, as I mentioned already, you can read our features and our opinion pieces and columns. Until next time, we will catch up with you very soon. Take care of yourselves and bye-bye.